Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
Dave.
And today we're back with more theory, but the good news is you don't have to listen to Dave and I talk today. We have Dr. LaShanta Bryce back with us. So LaShanta previously came on to talk about being a DCLS, and now she's going to share some COAG theory with us about routine COAG testing. So LaShanta, thank you.
Hi, everyone. I am here to talk about COAG theory, but really a focus on coagulation testing. And one of the things I want to start with is probably the thing that people don't like in coagulation, and it's the coagulation cascade. I'm not going to flash one on the screen because I don't want you to like have a panic attack about this. We're not going to go a whole lot of in-depth in it, but one of the things I want to point out is that the coagulation cascade actually has at least two different forms from a very high level. And those two different forms are the physiological cascade and the tube-based method. And why is this important when we start talking about coagulation testing? Well, from the laboratory's point of view, we always learn the tube-based method. And that makes sense because we have the tube in front of us. But in reality, our clinical partners, so our physicians, our PAs, our NPs, pharmacists, they all actually learn the physiological cascade. And that cascade does physically happen inside the body, so that's your in vivo. But one of the issues with that is that it looks slightly slash severely different than the tube-based method. Notably, factor 12 is actually not present on the physiological cascade. So it's just one factor, right? We don't need to know about it. Well, that's going to make a big difference when we start talking about specifically PTT and why that becomes very important when a clinician is taking care of a patient. But before we jump into that, we have to start with the basics. And the big basic is the tube. Coagulation for educational purposes is probably the easiest to associate because it literally only uses one color tube. It's not like clinical chemistry when I have like, you know, six or seven different color tubes and I can have multiple color tubes being used for the same assay. But in coagulation, in routine coagulation, it's always a blue top, guys. So if you're taking a registry exam and you're talking about coagulation, it's always going to be a sodium citrate tube. And that tube is a blue top. Now, when I talk about blue tops, I always quantify those and call them light blue tops. If the audience doesn't know, I have a sister that is a nurse practitioner, and her and I think very differently on color schemes. She is actually very artsy, and I am more not artsy as a scientist person. So oftentimes when I say blue top to our clinical partners, to include our nursing partners, sometimes I get a royal blue top sent for coagulation. And that is actually a blue top, but it's the incorrect blue top. So when I say royal blue, it's actually the color of my top today. That is the incorrect color tube to send for coagulation. That is a different anticoagulant, and it is actually tested in a different section outside of what we would traditionally call the hematology section.
So I actually want to interject. So as a silly hematologist who just knows his light blue tops, what's the additive in the royal blue?
It is a different form of EDTA, and it's usually used for trace metal testing. So that's also why we don't favor saying EDTA, because then the argument comes like, well, the royal blue top has EDTA. And I was like, that's actually not the form that we can use for CBC testing.
So everything's prolonged, LaShanta.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, that is a big issue. So speaking of that, the prolonged part, I have written an article before about pre-analytical factors and talking about what you can and cannot do with sodium citrate tubes or other tubes in sodium citrate tubes. And one of them is actually like, if I make a mistake while I'm drawing as a draw staff, I can't just simply pour over. And that includes combining two blue tops together. That also includes pouring a royal blue top into a light blue top or any other color tube into the blue top. Because those can have devastating effects that are not evident upon me just looking at the tube. So pre-analytical factors, out of the sections in the clinical laboratory, coagulation actually suffers the most from having a pre-analytical effect be magnified immediately. And the unfortunate part is that while we can see macroscopically by looking at the tube if it's appropriately filled, what we can't see is if you have done something kind of sketchy in the collection of the tube. So again, blue tops are super important. Even the type of blue top is also important. So we know that there are multiple vendors of blue top tubes, and those vendors have different fill lines. And most of the time, the medical laboratory professional is not necessarily involved in the collection of these tubes. So this is more in reference to inpatient collection. So for our collection staff that may be of varying scientific or clinical backgrounds, it's really important that they pay attention to that fill line. And that fill line varies between manufacturers. So for example, on the market, there are at least potentially 7 to 8 tubes that can be in circulation that are all blue tops. And at least 4 out of those 7 have different, very different fill lines. So one of the things to take in consideration is we heard at some of our joint annual meetings and our professional societies is how to educate our clinical partners about the importance of this pre-analytical variable. Specifically when we look at labeling, right? We know it's super important that we label the tube to come to the laboratory, but what is also important is that you do not cover up those fill lines. So we can appropriately see if the tube is appropriately filled. Unfortunately, from the vendor's perspective, that fill line is easily hidden by the label. So we can't simply just look at the top and say, oh, well, it looks like it's full. I was like, well, unfortunately, your label that we need to actually identify the patient is actually covering up the pre-analytical variable that we need to verify is actually accurate. In addition, the vacuum on the tube is important. We know that we have hard draw patients. I am one of those patients. Yesterday I had a big bandage on my hand from getting a blood draw myself, but I am actually ironically a poor draw person. So oftentimes I have to get drawn using a syringe because I have veins that will collapse very easily. There's a risk of doing that, right? We know we need to collect blood, but in that syringe, the coagulation cascade has already started, right? Your blood has exited your body and is now on its way to clotting in that syringe. So it is vital that you get that blood from the syringe into the tube in an appropriate manner. However, once you open that tube, the vacuum's gone. You don't get the assistance of the vacuum in the traditional sense of using a straight venipuncture or a butterfly system. Again, vitally important, underfilling is not great for coagulation. Also, overfilling is not acceptable either. The goal of this is to keep your anticoagulant ratio 9 to 1. And by looking at the tube, it is not your job to sit there and try to guesstimate what the 9 to 1 ratio is. You have fill lines for that. But in this case, for tubes that have specific fill lines, it is not best practice or warranted for you to overfill that tube. So for us, more blood is not great. So this is a little bit different of a variance that we would see potentially in hematology, where we would potentially be able to combine EDTA tubes for things like an ESR to get the fill line to an appropriate level. That is not okay to do for coagulation. So again, sodium citrate tube. And why sodium citrate? Because we need an anticoagulant that is reversible, right? So the whole goal of coagulation, guys, is to actually test if you can clot. So to do that, we have to have something that reverses the coagulation. So in this case, sodium citrate helps to have a reversible effect. So in testing, we actually add calcium back in. But during collection, we chelate it out using sodium citrate. We don't want EDTA because EDTA, if you think of it as a child versus an adult giving you a hug. Children, oftentimes when they interact with adolescents, they'll say like, wow, that like 2-year-old's really strong. I was like, they're not actually very strong. The problem is that they don't have any control of their grip strength. They use the same grip strength no matter what they do. Which is sometimes harmful to other small people, actually. But to an adult, you can usually manipulate your strength in what you're doing. So you will appropriately use normal pressure to give a hug, whereas a two-year-old will like squeeze the life out of whatever object they're holding, whether that be a human or a stuffed animal. In this case, EDTA is like the two-year-old. They don't want to give the calcium back. They're like, it's mine forever. I don't care what you give me. You can give me a cookie, a stack of cookies, and I'm still not going to give you back this calcium. Where sodium citrate's like, oh, well, I'll barter. Like, if you give me a stack of cookies, well, maybe. Maybe I can give you back this calcium.
I love that.
So think of it like that.
I love that.
So again, that's why we don't want you to actually pour over the EDTA, because then you're adding a bunch of two-year-olds to the scenario that we didn't ask for this specific purpose. So once we get past actually getting the tube collected appropriately, the next thing we now have to overcome inside the laboratory is selecting an appropriate centrifugation speed. This is really, really important, because as we talked about the process of hemostasis and coagulation, platelets are a major player in coagulation, and they are a source of lots of things that can impact your testing. And one of them is that platelets have a lot of phospholipids in them. So when we look at the phospholipid contribution of platelets impacting a test, if they are inappropriately included when testing, that will negatively impact a patient's result. So this is why we have to look at the centrifuge. And this is one of the big things that causes a contention point in the core laboratory. We know that the other disciplines look to the core laboratory for automation. And because we are experiencing a downstream effect of loss of personnel for various reasons, we have to look to automation. In most cases, we'll look to chemistry, with them being the leader in automation. And sharing a centrifuge sometimes is a good thing and sometimes it's not a good thing. So there are a lot of things that happen with the centrifuge, whether you're using the chemistry centrifuge or using a centrifuge offline. The first thing is that you have to guarantee platelet poor plasma. And the reason why is from a 20,000 foot level, you have no idea within the span of that sample whether testing is going to be added. So in theory, maybe I could get away with platelet-rich plasma for some of my basic coagulation tests. But if I call within time limits as a clinician to add on another test, that test can't really use platelet-rich plasma. So special coag tests like factors, lupus anticoagulant, protein CS, those definitely cannot use platelet-rich plasma. And yes, if you go in literature, you will see that there are cases where platelet-rich plasma is used for coagulation testing. However, as scientists, we have to take that into context, meaning was this used in a clinical setting? So yes, research and development wise, I can do lots of things. But the important part for us to remember is that research and development does not necessarily always translate into clinical science. So if you see platelet-rich plasma, make sure that they are using it in a patient care setting and not for development of an assay. Outside of just centrifugation, you have to also monitor the temperature of your centrifuge. We cannot actually use cold centrifugation for anything. Chemistry is a little bit more liberal. Coagulation is not. And it's not because we are prima donnas, right? We're not saying like we demand that we have our own centrifuge because we are our own section. That's not why we're doing it. It's because scientifically speaking, there are cold activations that can occur at not really cold temperatures, right? So basically a refrigerator, the places where you keep like your food, that will actually inappropriately activate things inside of your coagulation tube, notably factor 7. Factor 7, we know, is on our extrinsic pathway, the short pathway. So it is the quickest to be impacted. And there's not really anything else in the extrinsic pathway. So your PT testing will be immediately impacted. And that's just a simple thing, right? That's why we sometimes get into this kind of contention with clinical chemistry where we're like, we need our own centrifuge. But you have to be able to explain, not because you want your own for workflow purposes, but scientifically, why we cannot use a cold centrifuge.
That would lead to like a quickening or a shortening of the time, right? Of a PT.
Yes. So we know why that's a bad thing, and it's PT is a screening assay similar to PTT. However, we know that we do share some concepts with clinical chemistry, and oftentimes people kind of look at me with a confused face, or they send me like a confused face meme, like when I mentioned therapeutic drug monitoring in coagulation, like you do therapeutic drug monitoring in coagulation. And PT is one of them where we're looking at specifically a drug, warfarin slash Coumadin. And if you are inappropriately using a cold sample, like so when I say cold sample, for context, I'm talking about a blue top that has red cell components and the plasma, not a frozen sample. So not a frozen sample, guys. We know a frozen sample is just the plasma. But in the case of a full blood sample, that is where we can't have that cold happen with the whole blood sample. You can certainly freeze your plasma for testing at batch, but you cannot actually use a cold sample for routine testing, and we can't process it cold either. So that's something to keep in mind when we start looking at why we can't transport like whole blood samples to a different hospital in the case that you are not able to provide testing. The reason why, if you live like somewhere in Minnesota or somewhere that's actually cold, so not where I am, like where it's like 100 plus degrees forever in Texas, but and that's the reason why we don't let you transport your samples whole blood is to avoid those temperature fluctuations. So in addition to being too cold, you can also be too hot. So for example, if we were to stick some blue tops in my car right now, the day yesterday when I got in my car, it was 112 without the air conditioning coming on. So 112, once you get up to 136 degrees, you start losing factor activity, and these are your heat lay biofactors. So factor eight and factor five, no goes, guys. So people are like, 136 is really hot. I'm like, it is, but think about when you go to a clinic or you walk past one of these kind of urgent care slash pharmacy led initiatives where we're looking at COVID testing, for example. In the very beginning, you could go to a CVS or a Walgreens and get a COVID test, and that test was put inside of this metal box outside of the pharmacy. 112 degrees plus a metal box outside equals
Easily, right?
136 very
Yep.
quickly.
Yep.
So this is something to keep in mind when we're looking at things like courier transport, when you're trying to decide on whether you're going to keep special coagulation in-house or send it out. So all of these things are even before we even start testing. So again, coagulation is sometimes the forgotten child in the laboratory because it has the smallest testing volume compared to hematology and certainly chemistry. However, out of the three of them, they have the most amount of pre-analytical factors that can impact the initial set of routine testing. And this is also applicable to special testing because we know that factor testing uses the baseline of PT and or PTT to actually do factor testing. So if those two tests are now impacted, certainly your factor assay analysis will also be impacted. So once we get past the centrifuge and everything else that could potentially happen to the tube pre-analytically speaking, we're not quite done with pre-analytic. As soon as that tube comes out of the centrifuge, whether that goes to an automation line or it experiences human touch, then we have to start looking at quality of the plasma. So now there are two major things we have to look at. And the big one that is more obvious to people are the interferences. And this is hemolysis, icteria, and lipemia. Nowadays, many coagulation analyzers have what we would call a module on them to help you interpret hemolysis, icteria, and lipemia. And while this is more focusing on testing, we're not going to go down the HIL rabbit hole because it'll be a completely separate topic to talk about how to handle it. But it is something that the testing personnel have to be aware of because depending on the instrumentation's methodology and the actual assay's methodology will depend on what the person has to do with the HI and or LFLAC. In addition, one of the things that we also just kind of don't remember to look at until we think of it as a registry question, is the hematocrit level, right? So now we have to now look at, it's filled properly, but that ratio of red cell components to plasma might look a little bit off. And does that make a difference? Yes. Yes, it does. So in the registry, you'll oftentimes get this question about what do you do if the hematocrit is super high? Usually the number is 55%. And you'll have to do an adjusted sodium citrate tube. So that sample would initially be rejected. So you would not do any testing on it. You can verify that if you are unable to like physically see if it's on the line. You can go look and see if they had a CBC. Usually your hematocrit is not going to change significantly between the sodium citrate and the EDTA tube or the purple top. If you have a hematocrit that's like 65, 70%, you definitely need an adjusted citrate tube, which requires some math, or you can use a chart from a couple of guidelines. So ICSH, the International Council for the Standardization in Hematology, and the Clinical Laboratory Standards Institute both offer convenient charts for you to adjust that sodium citrate. Now we're going to go back a little bit to what I talked about earlier. So now that you adjusted the sodium citrate in that tube, now you have some more, yes, now you have some more things to worry about. One, that tube has to go to that patient. So that tube can't go back in the general population so we can use it for someone else. That tube was specifically adjusted for the person with the high hematocrit. Second, we've destroyed the vacuum. There's no way for me to get the sodium citrate out without destroying the vacuum, which now means that patient at a minimum is going to be drawn in some type of syringe, which puts the tube at risk of being inappropriately filled either under or over. So it's really important that the draw staff understands that that tube goes to that patient that we rejected the original sample for and that it still gets appropriately filled. Is that if it's inappropriately filled, the laboratory has to recreate another adjusted tube and resend it back. So one of the questions I get is, can I label? I was like, you mean with the patient label? No, no, you may not. That is not good practice because what can happen is literally that tube arrives to the floor. It doesn't go to the correct patient, gets sent back, and you do not know that it is the inappropriate person in the tube. So yes, it seems like that would be the best idea to label it with a patient that it's supposed to go to help the staff out, but in actuality, you may be causing inadvertent harm. So
good practice would be to label it with the ratio, the new ratio. Is that?
Yes, I would probably label with the new ratio, like very overtly. So with a lot of things like that are removable, of course, like so stickies, bright color Sharpies, anything that you can do to make that tube stand out to the draw staff. You of course cannot, 100% prevent this other than going up and drawing it yourself, which I do not recommend you doing because that is might be outside of your scope. But again, I highly discourage like appropriately labeling with the patient's name and MRN and date of birth and things like that, and then sending it to them because it can lead to inappropriate person landing in the tube. So now that we've gotten to past, we've checked it, we look for pre-analytical macroscopically speaking, now we can talk about what happens when we are talking about testing. So in general, your coagulation laboratory can be split into two different arenas. We look at potentially routine coagulation, which would include kind of your PT, PTT, fibrinogen, D-dimer testing. Then we can also maybe put something in the middle. I wouldn't necessarily call it specialized coagulation, but you may have special tests like thrombin time and anti-10A testing that would be a little bit more specialized. Then you have a complete split of actual specialty coagulation. And in the field right now, specialty coagulation is a unique area where they're experiencing a lot of loss of knowledge. And this actually is underpinned by lack of coagulation knowledge. It's hard for leadership staff to place members into the special coagulation laboratory if they are not very strong in routine coagulation. So when we look at where, what are we testing, right? We're testing different aspects of your coagulation cascade. Do you need to know that every time you pick up a tube? Yes and no. So when we look at our short pathway, right, we look at our extrinsic pathway, really the only factor that we're really concerned about is 7. But in reality, PT testing is much broader than just testing for issues with factor 7. The big goal of it, as I mentioned earlier, is still prevalent in the market, and that is for our patients that are on warfarin and Coumadin. And warfarin and Coumadin actually are trade name and non-trade name of the drug. The whole impact of that drug is to impact vitamin K dependent factors. So testing tip, how to remember those. Like I look at the cascade, I was like, well, which ones are they? It's a mathematical equation. So 2 + 7 = 9. And then we add one more and then we get 10. So 2, 7, 9, and 10 are your vitamin K dependent factors. So does Coumadin go in there and just kind of beat up the factor to stop it from working? Well, no, not exactly. It modifies the ability for that factor to work. So we don't, the intent of an anticoagulant is not to stop that factor from working, because then you would bleed immediately. The goal is to modify it so that it is not as effective. So anticoagulant would be to stop you from clotting. So we know our coagulation cascade, the end goal is to get to the bottom and form the stability of the platelet plug. So for PT testing, same idea here. We're looking at factor 7, but remember, PT testing tests the common pathway as well.
Yes.
So if factor 7 is doing just great, but we still have an elevated PT without the presence of an anticoagulant, then we may be looking at something wrong in the common pathway. The easiest way to confirm that would be to look across the way at the intrinsic pathway. And if the intrinsic pathway test PTT looks normal, then yeah, we have something going on in the common pathway. Now, all of these things that I'm talking about are in scientific theory. And this is something that's important for medical laboratory professionals to really think about. We are scientists and we put everything in theory. So the thing that I just said makes sense logically. But in reality, that might not be what your clinical team is actually thinking. So in the case where we talked about we have an elevated PT, the next logical step would be to run a PTT and ensure that the actual issue is in the common pathway. Now, what may happen is that you may get something called a mixing study, or you may still end up getting a factor 7 or. And oftentimes people think that the physician learns everything that we're talking about here. And they do for their registry or their certification exams, which are their USMLE exams to get to the next step in medical school. Once they get past that step, we throw it away. Which is not great. And they're not doing that on purpose. They're not like, oh, I just don't like coagulation, we don't need this. It is actually to make room for all of the other things that they have to know about. So for us, we learn a lot of things within coagulation. We learn about all of the things that happen inside the tube, all of the things that can impact what's happening inside the tube. But imagine learning that and then everything in the physiological cascade that can impact what happens in the tube beyond classifying it as thrombophilia or a bleeding disorder or a hemophilia. For us, if we're very honest with ourselves as medical laboratory professionals, we know that coagulation, learning all of the disease states is a lot. And there's a disconnect in education because we teach you all of these things, but then at the bench level, we don't see it. Until probably a little bit later in your career, where you have to then start making the connection about why I'm running a certain factor in the investigation of a hemophilia suspect patient. So again, the the variability that you may see with your clinical team, give them some grace on why you see that variability. And when there's a question, work together with your clinical team. So this may incorporate your pathologist, your lab director, yourself, to help a clinician understand. And this clinician may also be within our realm, right? I had a long conversation yesterday with one of my mentors, who's a what I would call a hematologist, even though the discipline is hematology oncology. He would be what I consider an actual hematologist that practices in this realm of coagulation and bleeding disorders. And the reason why we had the conversation was to talk about best practices for education for residents. And that included pathology residents who would eventually become your laboratory and medical directors. And the reason why we talked about this was because it is vitally important that we understand how we learn and how to communicate information back and forth to each other. It is really important for coagulation because oftentimes we think scientifically, we put our scientific hat on, we're like, we're going to give the most amount of information possible to our clinical partners. And the clinical partner is like, that's too much. And they get, the messaging gets lost. So in the case where I was talking to my hematologist mentor, I was asking, what do you need to know at the end of this? Is it appropriate for me to give you all of the information possible on the interference of PT and PTT testing as a comment? And he took a breath and said, absolutely not, LaShawn. Because all I need to know is how your testing impacts my patient's clinical path. Do I need to know if there is an impact with H, I, and L? At that point in time, if H, I, and or L happens, yes. Because I need to know if that result is clinically valid. And if you know that inside your instructions for use, it tells you that this level of hemolysis is now unacceptable, and one of my staff members has still demanded that you get the actual test result, you need to be able to communicate to me either commentary-wise or verbally, that this result is potentially invalid.
And this is a difficult conversation with our day-to-day laboratorians and professionals, right? Where I think at times it can seem like on the clinical team, the patient-facing clinical team, that maybe we're being difficult. And then there's more of a misunderstanding, right? So it's tough to, get the messaging right there.
Yes, it is hard because for us, we tend to think as medical laboratory professionals in, and certainly not in hematology, but this is one of the examples where we do a black and white approach, where we don't take into consideration the impact of the result. And that the reverse is true for the clinical partner as well. Mm-hmm. So they are demanding sometimes a result and they're not taking into consideration, scientifically speaking, that this result is potentially invalid. Yeah. So there is some education that has to happen back and forth where our medical laboratory professional group has to understand that there are times where we have to make what I would call an ethical decision in conjunction with your medical or laboratory director. And in order for you to make the best judgment possible, and they're not always going to be 100% correct, and they're not always going to be the same from institution to institution, it's important that you understand baseline what your methodology of your instrument can do and what the methodology of the assay is. So switching from that, you have at a broad level at least two different methodologies for instrumentation for clot-based tests on the market. So clot-based tests would be PT, PTT, fibrinogen. All of them end up as a clot. So like, that's confusing, Dr. Bryce. Like, it is very confusing. But clot-based tests, literally, the whole goal of it is to get a clot without any assistance from any other type of methodology. So PT, PTT, and fibrinogen are clot-based. Now, your instrument can actually read those two different ways. In chemistry, we learn a lot about optical detection. You learn about it in spectrophotometry. So think of it as I'm looking outside of a door and I'm looking to see, does a clot form? Okay, so I see it. I'm like, all right, this is what my number is. But it's a lot more complicated than that, but I'm simplifying it. So the second type of methodology is what we would call mechanical clot. That is where there is a detector in there with the clot, and it determines when the clot time stops. So despite fibrinogen being reported out in milligrams per deciliter, there is a time associated with that. So think of your clot-based tests. Those are all timed tests. Now, they may be morphed into a different reporting unit, but all of them have time-based components to them. Now, once you get past the clot-based test, you now have different methodologies that come into play. The instrument methodology is still in play as well. So when we think about D-dimer, all D-dimer assays that are on automated platforms use immunoturbometric methodology, meaning that it is basically an automated mini ELISA that occurs within some test system. So in this case, when we think about those interferences, we already have immunoturbometric. That means we're looking for a change in turbidness. So we can't have a color interference for these specific tests because all I'm looking for is a change in turbidity. Well, color can cause a change in turbidity, which would not be exactly what I was looking for. So when we think about hemolysis specifically, hemolysis is a no-go for D-dimer. And that's tough because usually where we see the largest amount of D-dimers coming in is actually in the ER. And those are the people that probably are going to have the hemolysis. So that is also to have that they may also cause a hard conversation with the ER where they have a patient that is just in hemolysis and they need a D-dimer. This is where it's vital that us as a laboratory community understand where our HIL module can assist and where that cutoff is, okay, this is no longer a valid test. And then being able to recognize if you don't have an HIL module, right? So certainly all generations of analyzers exist in the market, and not all of them have the assistance of an HIL module. So knowing that, that doesn't mean, oh, all is lost. I can't do anything. This is where it's important that we do some interdisciplinary work, right? You're not usually siloed into a single room by yourself where it's you and the coag analyzer and then nothing else. You can certainly walk across the way to clinical chemistry if your BMP or CMP is hemolyzing. Probably, and they've rejected their sample, might be like a best practice for you to consider rejecting yours as well. So there are ways around it, but it does require you to know what some of those limits are. So as not great of a read as people would say, and I would probably agree, it does our medical laboratory professionals some good to take a look beyond their standard operating procedures at their instructions for use every once in a while to make sure that when these kind of problematic situations come up, that you know where your information is coming from. And then taking a step further as you progress in your career, taking a look at the sources that were used to create your IFUs, right? So a lot of those come from standardization committees from different areas. So I mentioned two of them earlier, CLSI and ICSH. Another one that is more prevalent in coagulation would be the International Standardization on Thrombosis and Hemostasis, so ISTH, oftentimes is an underpinning document for both CLSI and ICSH on giving you some guidance on what are best practices in handling some of these difficult situations. So when we think about the other methodology that you'll encounter in routine testing would be chromogenic. And these are your anti-10A assays. Again, because these rely in an optical setting, so they're looking for a change in density, a change in your optical density, you can't have a color there. Because oftentimes the lamp that they're using is a red lamp. If you have red plasma, then the test will detect no change because you started off with an already present change. This is why
Change
we
in
can't have it.
redness
Yes,
is
there
hard
is
to
no change.
detect if it's yeah.
So again, it's really important that you are able to explain that, just like you said, David, a change in redness is not a detectable change. So this is why we're not telling you we can't accept it, because we are, throwing a dart at a dartboard and said, today we're going to reject your sample. We're doing this because we can't detect, or the instrument cannot detect a change. So this falsely high anti-10A result that I'm going to give you, you're going to plug that into an infusion pump, and you're going to make changes on the spot on this person's anticoagulation. And then when you get an appropriately drawn sample sent down, then it's going to result in another change. Dovetailing into that, the big conversation of why testing matters and why methodology matters, PTT versus anti-10A. This is the most unpleasant conversation I have as an educator in the clinical spaces, because in textbooks, right, everybody learns from a textbook at some point during their journey as a student. We still are very much on the soapbox of PTT for heparin therapeutic monitoring. And that in the beginning of time, so not in the dawn of the earth, but somewhat in that similar tone, we said that that was a test that you could use to monitor the impact of heparin. And that was true because that's all we had. That is not the case in present day. But unfortunately, textbooks are slow to maneuver themselves over to what is happening to catch up, scientifically speaking. So, in the case of laboratories, oftentimes you are involved at some point during your career as a medical laboratory professional who works in hematology and in coagulation. You will hear this talk about PTT versus anti-10A. And remember, this is why we talk about methodology. We just talked about what does PTT measure. It measures the intrinsic pathway and the common pathway. Again, it measures the intrinsic pathway and the common pathway, which means that anything that's going wrong in those two pathways is also going to show up in the PTT test along with the heparin. So there are various reasons why there are things that can go wrong with PTT. So inhibitors, so a lupus anticoagulant, can impact a PTT along with heparin. A factor VIII inhibitor, a factor IX inhibitor, or any other inhibitor of a factor can also impact a PTT along with heparin. So again, super duper important that we understand what the test is actually measuring, and then we can understand why maybe we don't use PTT for heparin monitoring exclusively. So all of these statements I'm saying are going to be in theory. They're not going to be 100% yes or no. And one of the things that is a counterpoint to this from our clinical partners is that anti-10A has impacts. I'm like, yes, that is true. All coagulation tests have impacts, unfortunately. And anti-10A's impacts actually are much shorter than PTT's because anti-10A measures 10A. The preanalytical impacts for anti-10A are much shorter because its target list is much smaller. With that being said, anti-10A's big impact actually comes from a different drug class. So, small pharmacology diversion, real quick. So, we talked about anticoagulants, and that's one of the big reasons why we test for things in coagulation. We talked about Coumadin, so we associated that with PT. Heparin, we're talking about that with PTT and anti-10A. And then there's a new drug of classes on the market that people have seen just on TV, right? So we've seen Eliquis and Xarelto. And in the very beginning of time of these drugs, we preached heavily, you don't have to monitor these. Never have to monitor these. If you look at those commercials now, you do not
Crazy
see that.
statement too. That to me, I don't. This is just me talking as an individual. But that was always ludicrous to make that claim. Sorry.
It is. It is. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the craziness of that statement and some of the minutiae of that statement. Anti-10A is ultimately impacted by the presence of direct oral anticoagulants. So why is this important that we know the name of the drug? The name of the drug, so not the trade name, so not Eliquis and Xarelto. That is what we tell the patient because that is the easier name for you to say. For the laboratory, rivaroxaban, apixaban, and edoxaban are your direct oral anticoagulants that ultimately target 10A. And how do we know that? Because all of those drug names I just said have XA in them. That is how you know where their target is. The other drugs that are DOACs, so the big one would be dabigatran, has a TR in it. TR would be for thrombin, its main target is 2A. Now, those drugs, the XA drugs, do impact anti-10A. So one of the issues that comes up is a patient that is being admitted as an inpatient, if they are on a DOAC, how do I appropriately transition them from the DOAC onto heparin when you just told me to use anti-10A, knowing that the target for the DOAC is 10A? I was like, yes, they say they share the same target. This is where some clinical judgment and some clinical discussions have to happen on what your goals are for that patient. But for the laboratory, it is still best practice for the majority of patients that are inpatient that are being monitored with unfractionated or loaded with unfractionated heparin to use anti-10A as opposed to PTT. Now, with that being said, should you know all of these pieces of information at the level of beginning your stages in coagulation, you're going to have to eventually know them because ultimately, even though we are sometimes encased in the laboratory, we are not immune to shifts in healthcare. As the population doesn't publicly get better, right? We're seeing an increase in chronic disease states. This is now going to equate to larger uses of things like direct oral anticoagulants. So when we talked about the minutiae of the statement, you don't have to monitor the drug. That statement is true, except in a case where you may have to do a measurement of the drug level. So this is different. So monitor is what we do for Coumadin and heparin, where we're actively using some type of coagulation test to give you a result that you're going to do an action with. Again, monitor equals action with. Measure is different. The direct oral anticoagulant, there are cases where you need to measure the drug present in the plasma. Now, this is super important that someone in the clinical laboratory understand the difference between monitor and measure. When I was growing up, towards like the last part of when I was working in the hospital, I had the opportunity to participate in our hospital's anticoagulation subcommittee. So this was in the very beginning of my DCLS career. There was an interdisciplinary group that formed this committee. There was an oncologist that asked the question when pharmacy demanded that direct oral anticoagulant assays be brought into the laboratory. His question was simple: why do we need them? Now, at the time, I didn't understand the question because I had not delved into the pool of coagulation intricacies yet. So I was a normal person, I think, where I was just doing testing. And I wasn't really, concerned with why am I doing it outside of like someone told me to do it. Later on, when I went through as a DCLS and began delving into the intricacies of coagulation, then I recognized why that question is valid. The reason why the oncologist asked that is because he or she cannot do anything with that value, meaning they cannot adjust the direct oral anticoagulant. So if I give you the actual value, it only means that you're aware. That's it. And the awareness really is important for the administration of a reversal agent. Unfortunately, Big Pharma has a big price tag on reversal reagents for direct oral anticoagulants. So adarosumab and indexinet alpha are highly expensive for the pharmacy to administer and carry in their formulary. So this is the reason why pharmacy was actually asking for assays to be brought into the laboratory. It was not for the purposes of monitoring, it was for the purposes of measurement. From the clinician standpoint, his question was valid. What do I do with the result? In the case of not using it for a reversal, it would be nothing. It would just be an extra piece of information. For the laboratory, they need to consider, is that extra piece of information without actual impact to the patient really necessary? So I think I have another appointment coming up. So yeah. I do have to end our session here today, but I'm certainly happy to schedule another session as well. So I know that was a lot of information at one time.
It was great information though. And I think I do want to add one tidbit to it. I think the other thing that they have to realize is when you do have the anti-10A assays on board is that they're still only looking at anti-10A activity. So it's not going to tell you this is the rivaroxaban activity. This is the apixaban. It's just going to tell you overall anti-10A activity. I think that's a big one for both laboratorians and students to understand with the anti-10A assay.
And that is one of the things that actually is a shocking moment for pharmacy to recognize.
Yes.
Because oftentimes we will say like, well, technically, if you had a patient come in that was not able to give you a history or had no historian present, and you had to make an educational guess on what the impact would be with taking a patient to surgery that potentially is on a direct oral anticoagulant, you would get a result with anti-10A. They're like, no, you wouldn't. I'm like, yes, you would. Mm-hmm. Because the goal of the anti-10A assay, even though I just said you should use it for heparin, it is based on the target. So it is a married piece of information. So this is not me arbitrarily saying like just run an anti-10A. Because if I ran an anti-10A on myself right now, nothing would happen because I have no 10A inhibitor drug on board. But because the direct oral anticoagulant is also a 10A inhibitor, it will show a 10A result. Now it won't tell you what the level of the drug is because we didn't calibrate the assay. So when we talk to our clinical partners, we don't want to talk to you about like how we do the calibration and what is all used. We want to impart to them the actual similarities between the drugs and why an assay shows activity. This also yields the reason why they're confused when they order a rivaroxaban level and an apixaban level and they get an answer. And they're like, why? I was like, again, the target is 10A. So if there is a 10A drug on, you're getting an answer. It does. The test does not correct for you inappropriately ordering an assay. So an anti-10A will give you a result. An apixaban calibrated anti-10A give you a result. And a rivaroxaban 10A calibrated assay will give you a result. So what I'm telling you is that what you are thinking is mass spectrometry, where we get the actual drug measure. This test technically is giving you the impact of target and associating it with a drug level. It is not going in there and saying, oh, molecularly speaking, I'm going to couple with a heparin or an apixaban or rivaroxaban metabolite, and that is your level. Like, that's not what's happening. So this is also why I tell you, like, the PTT test doesn't work out that great, because if there's something else going wrong with your patient, which chances are there are, that test is not solely giving you the impact of heparin.
Amazing. Well, LaShonda, thank you so much. We appreciate the time that you were able to spend with us. And we're happy to have you come back on to talk more about this kind of stuff.
Yes. Thank you guys so much. And I hope you guys were able to learn a little bit more about the important role that coagulation plays. And just remember that coagulation, the whole goal of it is to be able to detect a clot in a tube. So preanalytically speaking, we need you to give us a quality tube and we'll produce for you a quality result.
Absolutely. Well, LaShonda, thank you so much. And everybody else, thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye.